Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to be dealing a little bit with spices, which, as you know, I'm totally in love with. We're going to start out, actually, with a guy who's done a terrific job researching spices. This is Mark Stevens. And the book we're talking about is called Cooking with Spices. And it's going to be an absolute necessary reference book, I think, in the future, because he's done such a thorough job. Let's just listen to him. Mark Stevens, as I told you before we started on air, Cooking with Spices, your book, is actually the book I've been looking for. It presents everything I need to know or want to know about spices and how to put them together. It's 100 recipes for blends, marinades, and sauces from around the world. But what I love is that you really home in on each spice, its lore, its characteristics, its point of cultivation. What else do you want to explain about this book?
And that's wonderful to hear. Thank you so much for having me, by the way. I would like anybody who picks up this book to have a platform for easily, no pun intended, digesting how easy it is to work with spices, and especially new ones, and ones we may not be able to pronounce, or ones we're not familiar with, and how we can incorporate it into the things that we already love cooking, just to provide a different dynamic, a different element to it. And then once you open up those doors, you don't really need recipes. You can sort of innovate on your own. And so that's the ultimate takeaway.
Well, you are an interesting guy in general. I mean, you're a film director as well, right?
I'm a first assistant director on film. So, yes, I run film sets and schedule movies as well, and then I travel quite a bit as well. Actually, last year I made it to every single continent, all seven, in the calendar year.
Really?
Which was something that I always wanted to do as well, and collected stories and spices and whatnot along the way. But yeah, absolutely.
So what spice do you put with penguin?
Penguin.
Well,
if he went to all seven continents,
you don't eat penguins.
They do. Ernest Shackleton would say they
ate penguins.
Yeah, that they don't need spice because they didn't have them on those expeditions back at the turn of the 20th century. But I think it would go. You know, a good white pepper, green pepper mix would be pretty good on penguin, I think.
Oh, our grandson adores penguins. I mean, even when he was barely able to stand up, if you said penguin, he would break into a little happy feet dance.
That's amazing. I guess appropriately it would have to be white and black pepper, right?
There you go, yeah.
Oh, probably
a little turmeric, because you put turmeric in everything.
Exactly.
So, now, I got a lot of laughs in your book too, because I also had a Sicilian nona. You talk about your Italian nona, and how she would say just enough. You'd ask how much, and she'd say just enough. My grandmother thought that I was
backward,
retarded a little bit when I asked those questions. Because to her, there was no question about it. You just did it till it was enough.
Well, now the neat thing, I thought, this gives you an idea how precise this man Mark is. He was making his nonna's special pasta sauce, and he was supposed to put some of the spices in at the beginning.
All of them,
and he didn't put them in till the end, and it didn't taste right.
Yeah, she's a stickler, and you wouldn't know it because getting an answer out of her when you're trying to make her recipes, and I did one summer try to stay with her and make them all, and many of them I did, but God forbid if the FBI ever got a hold of her, it'd be a locked door case. They wouldn't be able to get any information out of her because she also is sneaky. It's not just that she won't tell you.
Yeah.
She'll wait until your back is turned to put like a little handful of something in. And you notice out of the corner of your eye. And you say, Nona, how much of that did you put in there? And to just shrug and wink and try to act coy, and you're like, I'm trying to preserve this for a future generation, Sona. You know?
Now, she's still in Italy, Mark?
She is. She's a ripe, young 92 years old. Yeah, and she lives with her sister, who's 95, and they're sort of like Harold and Maude. They bicker like an old married couple, and I'd love to make a TV show about it because they cook phenomenally, of course, but they're two beautiful, independent women who are still going and living on their own, although they have a housekeeper who's wonderful. And so, yeah, they're still there. I actually tested a bunch of recipes of the book at their house, which was a dubious activity at best.
That sounds like it.
No. Did you have any pre-existing mission to writing this book?
I have always been interested in flavors, and I feel like I was well-rounded in spice knowledge. Though I didn't have a mission to write this book, the publisher and the editor there, who is wonderful, and I both wanted this book to be approachable.
Yeah.
And other spice guides at times can be very intimidating and very dense, and they're written from the perspective of somebody who knows everything about the spice already and expects at times the reader to. And they also often are in alphabetical order. So Anardana, Amchur, Ajuan, those spices at the beginning, and, you know, turmeric and zedoary at the end. However, if you don't know about the spice or where it's from, and you want to cook Asian food or Indian food or whichever region, you don't necessarily know to go to that letter of the alphabet and find that spice. So this book wanted to be written from the perspective of a home cook who's also learning, which I definitely was, and I learned so much more about the world of flavors and spices during this process, so that it could be digestible, approachable, because I'm on the adventure too, right? I'm on the journey. I acknowledge my own shortcomings, and it's more funny than it is anything else. It's not limiting at all, but when you think a certain thing, a certain spice is one thing, and you've heard all your life that it's really either spicy or unedible or doesn't go with this, and then you find out that it goes with all these different flavors, and of course these spices have had a conversation with each other for the last 500 years of commercial culinary trade. A lot more of them go together than we want to maybe expect, and I wanted to communicate that. And so also the book is based in chapters regionally, so India is a chapter and Asia is a chapter, and the spices in those chapters are from those regions that were first cultivated there. Of course, they have traveled and are now domesticated and cultivated in different areas too. But if you want to cook Indian food, you have a chapter with those spices are there. They probably go together pretty well. They're going to link with other chapters too, but at least you can sort of get a holistic sense of what's going on between these guys. So that was sort of the idea, and it turned out to be super fun. And I also wanted to include a lot of the lore, because spices are rooted firmly in mythology and lore and superstitions and witchcraft. And if you pick up a magic book of note, there's all these tricks you can do, you know, turmeric under the doormat to ward away this or that. And yeah. That's really interesting to me too. So I wanted to include that as well.
Now, I thought it was interesting. You have a lot of friends who are obviously spice oriented as well, because you name particular people who created this sauce or this other thing. So you must have a fairly wide circle of acquaintances.
I tend to think I do through travels, and also my work lends itself to meeting new people, because if I do a film, I am for 3 months with an entirely new group of people. And some of them are super interesting, like Alfre Woodard, who's a award-winning actress, lent two recipes to the book and a great story about asafoetida, which is a really stinky spice.
Yes. And what was she called it? Her mother told her to call it. How did she pronounce it?
Asfiti, I think it was.
Something like that.
And she told me that story, and I was dying. And, of course, I asked her if I could put it in, and she goes, of course, no problem. So I wanted to also make – I wanted to use my resources, and I wanted, hopefully, people to feel like this comes from a community. They have a community, and they can sort of branch out themselves, sort of like the roots of a tree versus the branches, two sides of the same coin. And – the world is so big, and spices are not just connectors of people in my group, but that is how they have proliferated throughout the history of time. From the point when the Dutch took over the Spice Islands and burned all the clove trees down except for on the one island of Ambon, and then had all of their traders and merchants tell people in the ports of Southeast Asia and Europe and the world that these spices came from floating islands that disappear each night and reappear in a new place every day so that nobody could locate the source, and they controlled the clove and nutmeg trade for 200 years. You know, legends and stories and friendships and dinners and communities and nations have been built on these things. So it would be very limiting for me to just try to do it myself. So I branched out as much as possible to try to get some really interesting characters involved and have some more stories, and that's what came out of it.
Well, you know, it's okay. There's so many interesting, I don't know which one to turn to. I mean, there's so many interesting stories about these. Which do you find, when you were doing your research, what was sort of the most intriguing of the stories and the uses and the whatever is surrounding the charisma of these spices? What are some of your, not necessarily favorites in terms of what you'd like to cook with, but what did you find the most interesting to research and write about?
There's so many. Some didn't make the book, actually. I turned into the publisher. They requested 45,000 words, and I think I turned in 65,000. And
yeah, this is the story I get from every writer.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the really cool ones, I saffron, as we were discussing before we got on the air, and is a really cool one because it built a hospital, literally, in Italy. I mean, it's such a refined technique, and now there's cooperatives doing it to try to bring back sort of the old way trade. But one of the really interesting ones that not a lot of people are familiar with is the story of allspice.
And yeah, allspice, tell us about that, because you really kind of sorted that through for me.
Yeah, allspice is sort of, I don't know, the James Bond of the spice world. Like, where does it even come from? And sort of secret agent-esque, because not few people think that allspice is a collection of spices, almost like curry.
Mm-hmm.
And many people think that curry is a spice as well, when it's actually a collection of spices, including your favorite there, turmeric. And allspice is a spice that when Columbus and the conquistadors came to the New World, in quotation marks, of course, it was there for a very long time before that, thought they had found pepper, which was a highly, highly valuable commodity in those days, and brought it back and made its rounds in Europe. It found its way to England, and they couldn't quite pinpoint it, right? So it had, you know, if you smell allspice, you can really detect black pepper, nutmeg, and cinnamon. It's sort of, you know, this, it's one of the pumpkin spices in that sense, and very earthy and wonderful, and it made its way. It's obviously its own spice. And we, as Americans, don't have necessarily as many culinary traditions as some of the countries of the old world that they love to give us guff for. But we do have barbecue. And we can, the New World owns barbecue in many ways. But barbecue comes from allspice, because way back in the day when pirates and you know, the lords of the sea were dancing around the Caribbean in their tall boats, they would go back to their coves, pirate coves and pirate bases and whatnot, and they would slow roast meat, pigs, with the allspice branches, the branches of the allspice tree.
So they would use the tree. They wouldn't use the fruit. They would use the tree.
They would use the tree.
Oh, my.
And,
oh, my.
And the barbecue was called boucan, like the French
right.
Boucan. And so they became boucaniers, right?
Yeah.
Which boucaniers then becomes buccaneers.
And that's where
the word buccaneers comes from,
it.
Which is and guess really what? Crazy, yeah.
And guess what? It's the nickname of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
The nickname of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yeah, they're also known. They're also known as the Bucks.
Exactly. now, incidentally, the University of New Orleans as well, where I live.
Now, here's a funny thing for you. We buy spices in a variety of different places. One place we buy them in bulk, and we buy a pepper blend in bulk. But they put allspice in it, and the unfortunate thing about it is that it jams the pepper mill. So you have to go through the mixed peppers and pull out all the allspice, otherwise it jams the pepper mill once again. And where Pennsylvania Macaroni got the idea of doing that, I have no idea.
Oh, lots of places do that, not just Penn Mac.
Yeah, I mean, allspice must be cheaper than peppercorns.
Yeah, well, that leads us into another thing. You have good tips in terms of buying spices, and some of the stories about how the merchants cheat really kind of sicken me. About the open barrels of spices in certain countries and how they extend them, shall we say, with fillers and what those fillers might be.
Yeah, this is I'm sure a practice that extends beyond our years and perhaps beyond our country as well, but they can get pretty crafty. And did you want me to talk about that at all, Anne?
Yeah, I mean, everything just tips.
There's a kind of a neat warning in there for someone who thinks they're shopping the souk for the first time and thinks they're getting the real thing.
Right. Well, it's a pretty sexy thought, right? We sort of want to go into this feeling like Indiana Jones, you know, sort of evaluating the spice market and going from stall to stall and picking up this or that. And it can get dicey.
Yes.
It definitely can. You know, when you have a open spice that's open to the world, anything can really contaminate it, both accidentally and incidentally. One of the accidentally things that can happen is, of course, a small bug or pest that's native to that region can find a happy and delicious home in the bed of some sesame seeds or whatever it may be, and you very innocently buy a package of it. They put it in the bag, they wrap it up, you throw it in your bag, you come back to the United States or wherever you live, put it in your spice cabinet, and then all of a sudden there might be an infestation of a invasive creature. Then nobody wants that. And of course, one of the intentional ones is filler, and specifically, you know, saffron, if you buy it powdered, is often filled with turmeric and other fillers. And at times there's been reports of things, everything from earth or dirt to feces been found in open spice stalls. So, of course, the best thing to do is buy from a trusted dealer, and sometimes if you have a friend in that region, they can take you to their spice shop, which I've happened before, and anywhere from London to Tunis. And then the other thing is, like, it's okay to trust a packaged product. It may seem very flashy to buy when somebody's scooping out of a big open thing, but generally packaged items are, if you're buying it at the source, is still fresh. And then also, you have the benefit of knowing there was some production process. The other thing to keep in mind is that most places save their best product for export.
Yes.
So you're not always buying the best thing at the market, even though you may be close to the source. And that happens here as well in the United States and Italy and other places. And an example of that would be like quinoa in Peru, which has its own problems.
Yeah, but they're having a lot of problems keeping up with the demand for quinoa.
Yeah. And so the best thing to do, of course, is just buy from known trainers, and there's various other things. And of course, chapter one of the book is all about that. So if you go to Amazon and click on Cooking with Spices, you'll get all that information.
You can actually go straight through our website as well if you'd like.
Oh, great! Perfect.
We can do that too.
I just say, listeners, this book has more than just like descriptions of herbs and spices. He tells you even like what partners with what, which I thought was very interesting because I had never thought of some of those combinations. And then what the combination of spices would go with in terms of the food. And as well as, it's such a rich book. It's, I think, destined to be a major research and reference book, Mark Stevens. It's Mark C. Stevens, I might say. And the book is, again, called Cooking with Spices. And congratulations on it, and good luck with your rollout of the book.
Thank you so much, Ann and Peter. I very much appreciate it. It's so wonderful to talk to you guys.
Oh, you too, Mark. Thank you.
See, the guy really does know what he's talking about,
sure
right?
Sure does. Yeah. He really knows.
Amazing thing about it is he has a day job.
Yes, right.
Just to get you missed it on the way through, he's a first assistant director on movies. I think that means something special, but I don't know exactly what it is.
I don't know, but I know his website has his name in film.
There you go.
So I think that's pretty important too.
Anyway, we're staying on a spicy theme, so don't go away because we'll be right back in just a moment.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I think you're going to be hearing a lot from Lee White. She started her tea company in her 50s, Mendocino Teas, and then just recently discovered the power of turmeric and some other spices that help charge your life. What is it? I call them vitality teas.
Yeah.
And she calls
them tonics.
And they're called tonic. And she's going to talk to us about that. But more than that, she's also, she's 72 or 3. And she's...
I didn't count.
Well, whatever. She's going to be making inspirational, is it called? Motivational speeches about encouraging women to follow their dream at whatever age. Well, let's hear Lee White talking about her tuber tonic and super tuber tonic, which I've been drinking every day.
Yeah, incidentally, Anne's been drinking this like 3 or 4 cups every day.
And am I more energetic?
and supplementing with fresh turmeric root. Turmeric is magic, it turns out.
Lee White, you have been cooking your whole life, you said, and you've been making a tea called, under the label Mendocino Tea, and then just recently you started producing something called Tuber Tonic and Super Tuber Tonic teas, which I have been guzzling for the last week or so. They have certain ingredients in them that have health benefits, right?
They do indeed.
Talk to me about your, why, first of all, why are there different grades of these? Like, there's one, it's two, an organic, another one is a the tuber tonic. The other one is the super tuber tonic. I mean, are they different strengths?
They are. A lot of people who drink the tuber tonic found that they wanted as much tonic, as much turmeric as they could get. And so I doubled the turmeric and the recipe. And so basically they're the same recipe, mm-hmm. but with the double turmeric, they're getting more of the turmeric benefit. And the other thing that happened, the tuber tonic is quite spicy. You probably noticed. And
yeah,
with
the
double turmeric.
I sliced some fresh tuber, turmeric root in mine.
I see. Okay. Well, you know, with the double turmeric, it just makes it a little bit less peppery, you know, and it's such a great taste.
I like it. Yeah, it makes me feel healthy.
Makes people healthy. It's anti-inflammatory. I'm not a doctor, so I can't say specifically, but rumor has it. I've done a lot of research on it. Rumor has it that turmeric is quite anti-inflammatory. In fact, 4 out of 5 of the ingredients for this tea are anti-inflammatory. And then the 5th one is elderberry, which is rumored to be antiviral.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the one that I haven't laid hands on yet, the elderberry.
It's pretty wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I have to get some of that.
I needed to speak up a little bit.
Yeah. Could you speak up a little louder?
I can.
Great.
Yeah,
that's
I've been known to do that before. How's this?
Okay,
better keep it up there.
Now,
okay.
So what we're talking about is with the tonic is that these are teas with ingredients that have health benefits and you give instructions. You can boil them up. You can have them hot. You can have them cold. And it's your focus now. We were calling them something else, but what led you to try to do this kind of thing when you were doing fine with your regular fine teas?
Well, you know, Anne, I had a friend who was very dear to me. She had stage 4 cancer. She went to a clinic, a cancer clinic, and they did a whole bunch of tests on her, and they said that the one thing that responded best to her cancer was turmeric.
Wow.
And we tried all kinds of things, getting the turmeric into her. We cooked with it. We made a tea with the fresh turmeric. We did as many things as we could. Now, her cancer moved into her liver quite quickly, and we were not able to save her. But I felt so strongly that if there was something out there that was as clearly antioxidant as turmeric, that it should be put out there for the public. And then, after that, I learned that turmeric is a specific anti-inflammatory for arthritis.
Yes.
Well, I have arthritis,
yeah,
you
so
know,
do I.
So all the more reason to come up with it. And I started by making fresh teas with fresh organic turmeric and fresh ginger. And then apparently you can get it most of the year now fresh, but at the time when I started playing with it, it was hard to get fresh turmeric all year round. So I thought, well, you know, we should have something that has a shelf life, you know, that could be made up at any time and can sit on the shelf until you need it. Although I find that I drink tuber tonic every day.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I do that, or I will do my own version of it, but absolutely the turmeric is a go with me.
It is.
Yes. There's a study that someone was telling me about where they took 100, 150 people, whatever, and half of them they put on turmeric and the other half on 800 milligrams of ibuprofen. And they drank, it was not their very much quantity, actually. It was like 2 cups a week or something, or 1 cup every 2 weeks. But the inflammation rate was, it was decreased better and faster and controlled better by the turmeric than by the 800 milligram ibuprofen.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I believe it. It makes a huge difference. Actually, it's pretty funny. When I first started making it, I was drinking it every day. My body just craved it. And so I was drinking two or three cups a day. And then, you know, something happened, and I was doing something else and not thinking about it, and I didn't drink any of the tuber tonic for a day or two. And all of a sudden, you know, my arthritis started kicking up, and I'm going, what's going on? Why is this happening? How come I ache? And then I remembered, oh, I should make some tuber tonic. So I went back to it, and that it's been pretty, I've been drinking it pretty constantly ever since.
Now, you were recently at the Fancy Food Show, the West Coast Fancy Food Show. How was this tea received?
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. There are 20,000 people, supposedly, that go to that. There are 1,500 vendors. And I have this little tiny booth that's along with a whole bunch of other booths from California. And people would come by, and they would have a cup of it. They like the way it tastes, and we started saying, listen, you know your feet are going to hurt after you've been walking around all day long, so come on back. Well, we had people from actually the other booths started coming back every afternoon and singing the praises of the tea, and it kind of became a habit for people to swing by to a couple times a day. So I picked up a bunch of customers that way, and certainly a lot of fans. It was really amazing.
Well, that's good. And what are some of the other ingredients?
It's turmeric, ginger, elderberry, cinnamon, and black pepper. And I use true cinnamon, which is from Sri Lanka.
Right.
And
which is more expensive.
It's milder and sweeter than the cassia cinnamon that most teas use.
Yeah, I don't like that cassia stuff. Somebody gave me a whole bunch of cassia broth, bark, and I couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
Very harsh, and it tasted sort of woodsy to the extreme, like rotten woodsy.
Yeah, it's pretty pungent stuff.
Yeah. So anyhow, so you have this market you're developing. You have a lot of orders to fill now. You could continue selling what you're doing. What are your plans? Are you expanding? Are you down the line? What do you envision yourself doing with your tea lines?
Actually, you know, I really believe that this tea should be expanded as much as possible. So as many people as can will be drinking it. I'd like to see it be right straight down the line in between coffee and tea. It has no caffeine. And so people can start drinking it in the afternoons when they don't want to be drinking caffeine and they want something that won't keep them awake at night. I want to get it as big as possible. I love the idea of it. But at the same time, since I began the tea company in 2003 when I was 58 years old and thought maybe I was too old to start a business, I want to go out there and tell women to follow their dreams. I want to do motivational speaking. I love speaking to groups of people. And I think now is the time for women to be hearing as much information as possible about what a positive change it is for them to go into business after their kids are grown and they have a little time to be creative in the manner that they've always wanted to be.
Now you're a little bit out of the way there, aren't you? You're not just down the road from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or just down the road from San Francisco. Put a dot on the map for where you're doing this wonderful work, and then tell us some more about how people can get this tonic for themselves.
And your website.
And my website. Okay. Well, the easiest place to get tuber tonic at this point is at Amazon.com.
Okay.
There you go. Boy, those Amazonians, man, they're taking over the world, aren't they?
They are. They are. So I'm really happy to be there. I don't have the super tuber tonic on there yet, but I intend to sometime soon. I've been too darn busy to sit down and do what I need to get that together. But tuber tonic is there, and it's the good stuff. So they can order a bag of that, and then MendocinoTea.com is my website, and it's easy to order from that. It's a Shopify site, so there's a shopping cart, and I'm happy to send it out from here. And you're right, we're quite remote, but it's a good thing.
And you're about to debut a chai?
I have invented a chai that I adore, and I keep it on my stove at all times. I have a wood stove. So I keep my chai warm on the wood stove all day, and it's tuber tonic chai. So it's basically all the ingredients that are in tuber tonic, but I've also added black tea and Earl Grey tea and cardamom and cloves.
Oh, that sounds good.
Oh, it's delicious.
I'll
have to send you guys some. I think you'll like it.
And you live up there with a special friend whose first name is the same as mine.
Special friend. We've been married for over 25 years, yes.
Oh, well, Ann and Peter have been married considerably longer than that.
Ah, you lucky people.
But Ann's the one who drinks tuba tonic.
Yeah. And I love it. It's a great product, and I want to congratulate you on moving forward with this. You could have rested in your laurels with Mendocino tea, but you've tackled a whole new area of expertise, fulfillment. So congratulations to you, Lee White.
Yeah, Lee, thanks a lot for being part of the show.
Thank you so much, Ann and Peter, for reaching out, finding me, getting me on your show.
Thanks. Bye, Lee.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
One of the most respected names in the arena of cookbook authors is Paula Scheuer. And she specializes in Jewish cooking, and her latest book is, you might think that it's an oxymoron if you grew up with the kind of Jewish cooking that was popular back in the day, I guess is what they say. But this book is called The Healthy Jewish Kitchen, and Paula has found ways of getting the soul food, the Jewish soul food that everybody loves, and having it be nutritious, heavy on grains, eliminating a lot of the extra fat. It's a really good cookbook to have. Anyhow, here's Paula Scheuer. Paula Scheuer, it's always good to have you on a phone interview with us. I think you agree that this is your third phone interview with us. But you have four books out. The current one that we're going to be talking about is The Healthy Jewish Kitchen, Fresh Contemporary Recipes for Every Occasion. And I must tell you that we have been getting a lot of books about adjusting traditional Jewish cuisines to make it healthier, lighter. I mean, in its basic form, it wasn't all that healthy, right?
Well, it really depends. I mean, there's always been salads in our culture, but a lot of the salads had sugar in them. A lot of them were mayonnaise-based. A lot of the food is a little on the heavier side.
Yes.
People like to eat what we call kugel. It's like a like a quiche. It's made out of a lot of vegetables and eggs and some kind of binder to hold it together. So people were eating, there's still parts of the Jewish community where people are not eating well. They're eating too much heavy food. So I decided it was just like time to kind of move the community in a healthier direction.
Right. What was it I had that almost sent me to the hospital? What was that? Stuffed chicken neck, I think it was.
Stuffed derma.
Oh, gosh.
Stuffed derma.
Yeah, stuffed derma.
Stuffed derma, oh, yeah. There's a lot of junk in that. Yeah, I don't make that. I haven't eaten that. I don't know, probably at least 20 years or so. Yeah, people buy those and put them into stews and soups and things like that. But, yeah, not my thing. But I've always eaten, you know, pretty healthy food, but in this book, what I tried to do was kind of go one step further, and I took a lot of recipes from my childhood that I grew up with, like coleslaw, for example. And instead of using mayonnaise, I take a mango and I put that in a blender or food processor with onions and lime juice and jalapeno, and I make a dressing out of a mango, and that's what holds my coleslaw together.
You see, now I was going to conclude that saying about we're getting lighter and more healthy books about Jewish cooking, but you take it a step further. You add this whole other element of the personal creativity in sort of the contemporary context.
Right, because I want healthy recipes to be appealing to people, and I always love to try to bring general food trends to the Jewish community.
Uh-huh. And, you know, the other thing you do, which it took a little thinking, is to combine both the Sephardic and Ashkenazi.
Right, because I think that, at least today, there are so many, what, like we might call like a mixed marriage of an Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jew. So in so many households, there's so many different food traditions coming together. So I feel like a cookbook should reflect that. I'm not going to write an entire book ever on Sephardic cooking because I don't have that expertise. But I've incorporated some of those flavors, some Middle Eastern. Sometimes I've taken Eastern, you know, real classic Eastern European dishes and just made them more modern.
Yeah, but I guess with this emphasis on Israeli cuisine and
restaurants. Oh, I'm so happy that Israeli cuisine is just becoming more mainstream because I've been going to Israel for years, and the food is so fresh and so delicious and simple, and it's a great cuisine to introduce to people around the world and in America because the recipes aren't always that complicated and they're just very fresh.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're wonderful. You know Alon Shaya in New Orleans?
I have not met him, but I know of him, yes.
Yeah, I mean, he was good. And then, of course, Michael Soldamano in Philadelphia.
Yeah, his restaurant's wonderful. His cookbook is wonderful.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I'm just really happy that this kind of cooking with an emphasis on vegetables is what's become very trendy because I've always eaten that way, and I've always had lots and lots of side dishes and salads in my meals, so I'm so happy that other people are doing that as well. It's a great way to eat.
Now, here's the one page, I guess it might be two pages of this book, that makes it worth every penny that you spend on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how to make latkes without making a mess.
Yeah, I did those last night. I did an event in Northern Virginia, and I did a workshop with 30 people, and we made baked latkes. And I, you know, it was one of those ideas in my head that I wasn't sure was going to work out, or that I was able be able to convince my twin boys, my twin teenage boys, that they would want to eat it. So I played around with different methods and ended up developing a method of, you know, heating the oil on a pan in the oven and then putting in your latke batter onto the pan and then baking it. So you use, you know, mere tablespoons of oil as opposed to, you know, an inch of oil in a frying pan.
Now, here's the reason for it, because I converted my grandchildren to loving potato latkes, which I love, and I like to have any possible excuse to make them.
But everybody loves latkes,
yeah,
but when I got this recipe right, my twins were thrilled. Like, they love them.
But wait a second. I got banned from my daughter-in-law's kitchen.
Oh, no. I'm sorry, Peter. That's terrible.
He set off the smoke detector.
No, I don't have to do that anymore because I know there's another way.
That's very funny. That's funny. Yeah, I...
You're twins. I mean, boys that age. I mean, you have four children. I don't know how you have time to write a cookbook.
I don't know, but I only have two in the house, although the older children still require air traffic controlling on a regular basis. The twins, they eat a lot. I mean, they really want food around all the time. And, you know, I'm a baker. You know, I've written two baking books, and I'm known as the kosher baker, but they walk in the house, and they want food. They want soup. They want schnitzel. They want, like, food. They don't want to start with desserts. They'll eat the desserts, but first they want food.
Well, now they must be great critics, though.
Yes, they are. We had to teach them when they were younger that they could not go to somebody else's home for dinner and not comment on every aspect of the meal, honestly.
Really? That's a hard thing to do. I mean,
because at home, they're allowed to say whatever they want. They can criticize anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have issue with, we just fed ours what we were eating. I just making a special meal is like beyond me. And
right, and that was one of the things that, you know, that's how I had my first two children in Switzerland, and I really learned from watching all the doctor I had there, the pediatrician, and other parents around me, how they get their children to eat vegetables. They just keep introducing them over and over again. They don't give a kid broccoli, and the kid doesn't like it, and they give up, and the kid never sees broccoli for 2 years.
Exactly.
You just keep giving them that same vegetable all different ways, and eventually you will find a way that they will eat that vegetable. And, you know, the recipes I have in the book, the various salads and side dishes, my kids really love. So you have, there's so many interesting ways to combine recipes and herbs to come up with something that everybody would want to eat.
Yes, well, your philosophy lines up with ours, but not with some of our grandkids.
Yeah, no, and I really, and you know what, you like I said, I'm a baker by training. I love pastry, and I feel that if you eat the food in the healthy Jewish kitchen, then you will have room for dessert. You won't be so heavy and full that you wouldn't want to eat dessert, or you'd feel just completely decadent and over the top and feel ill to eat dessert. It's all about balance. You know, if you're eating lighter food, then you could have some room for dessert. But what I tried to do in this book with the desserts was try to lower sugar and salt and fat as much
right.
as I could and introduce whole grains so that, yes, it's still rugelach. It's still that cookie that you love from your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to add a little whole grain to it and put a little bit less sugar in the dough and the filling, and it'll be better for you than your typical version.
Yeah, we interviewed a woman. Her book was Deepest Secrets, and she and her husband are Indian. And her husband had diabetes. And so she took over the classic Indian dishes that he loved, and she streamlined them, modernized them, eliminated a lot of the gratuitous carbs, and she claims that she got him to the point where he didn't even have to have insulin injections.
That's incredible, but you really can change medical conditions with food. Some of them you really, really can, but you have to take it very seriously. I recently taught my younger brother, who is pre-diabetic, to start baking his own bread from scratch with sourdough starter, and he's so proud of himself. He's making beautiful breads now, and by cutting out, you know, white flour from his diet, he was able to get out of that characterization altogether.
Well, now that leads us to something. We've said what you're doing, but give us some specific examples. For example, since you are a baker, what do you do to lighten up and make healthier your baked goods?
So for just as an example, like I would say your typical scone recipe is going to have 2 cups of flour. You can take 25%, so like a half a cup of flour, of white flour, and substitute spelt or whole wheat flour in that recipe and not really have to change anything else, and it will work out fine.
And how much more healthy is that, or how much
healthier? It's just 25% more. You're getting more fiber into your diet than you had otherwise.
I see.
I think that for some people, you're not going to get them to go from all to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like my recipes are a way to kind of move you away from this mindset of overly sweetened and overly white flour desserts, and to make desserts that are better for you. I'm not saying like that my, you know, rugelach are healthy. They're just healthier than your typical version of it. It's homemade. It's made with, you know, natural ingredients and some whole grain. The same thing with my babka has spelt flour. My strudel has also some whole wheat flour. So that you're adding some nutrition into your desserts and not just like have it be empty calories.
And you've introduced where I find this amazing that vegans have discovered aquafaba.
Oh, that, it's like magic. Like
isn't
you're literally
it?
Taking the liquid from the chickpea can that you dump down the drain. You're taking garbage, and you're turning into chocolate mousse. It's just, you know, I didn't invent the method, but once I tried it, I thought, oh, this, I got to share this with my people because I thought it was just genius.
I do too. Yeah, you have a lot of trendier elements in here, like introducing matcha,
mm-hmm.
which is so healthy.
Yes, I tried desserts in Asia years and years ago, so I've been baking with matcha for years. I have a matcha hamantaschen in my holiday kosher baker book, which is really nice.
I don't remember that, but I remembered.
Is that the stuff they call Peruvian Viagra?
Which?
Matcha?
No.
Matcha? Oh, I couldn't help you with.
No, there's an ingredient like that. It's a very similar.
All right, you're going to get back to me on that.
I'll get back to your husband secretly.
I'll tell you this. One of my favorite herbs or herb blends is Zatar, and that's popping up all over the place now.
I've been using that for years, and sumac. I love sumac. I have that in a salad in the book. I think it's fun to, you know, give people the tools to use new ingredients. So when they go to the store and they see something or they read your recipe and they say, oh, that's a new spice I don't know, they'll go out and try it.
Yeah, but I like also that you take these classics like paella and what's the South American thing?
Oh, the arroz con pollo.
The what?
Arroz con pollo.
Oh, yeah, no, I was thinking the feijoada. I made that
one.
Oh,
the Brazilian dish. So, yeah,
that was not low calorie, I'll tell you. I made it. It was really heavy duty.
Well, it's interesting. Like, the classic Brazilian recipe has every cut of the pig in it. And obviously, as a kosher person, I wasn't using that. But I thought that the whole concept behind it was that there's different textures in the dish. And so that's why I have different cuts of meat. And what I tell people is, like, see what you can find. If you don't find all of one cut of meat, try a different cut of meat. And use more of one or less of another. I mix up the beef with the veal and just to give a different texture. But I have to make it again once the weather gets really cold because I really enjoy that dish.
Yeah, I like it, but I demurred because of all that fat.
Oh, I can fully appreciate that. Yeah. But I think with my virgin, because it's cooked for a while,
I'll try that.
You could use leaner cuts of meat, and it would still be good. Yeah.
Now, I didn't mean paella. I meant bouillabaisse.
The bouillabaisse. Yeah. Okay, so, you know, I spent so many years in Europe, and I would walk around the south of France and pass by these restaurants, and I'd look at people eating this gorgeous soup stew, like this beautiful color, and just there was never any version other than the classic one. So I had it in my head for a long time that I wanted to get this right, and I finally did. But I have, you know, I have three different kinds of fish in it and some vegetables. So I put purple potatoes in to be my mussels and red peppers to be my shrimp.
That's
so
great.
I had fun with it.
Now, you're somebody whose opinion I trust, and you know what you're talking about. So
she's about to ask you for money.
No, I'm asking you. What is this big attraction to charred cauliflower?
I saw it on a restaurant on a menu in Philadelphia a couple of years ago, and I loved the taste of it. I do a lot of vegetables on the grill, and I will give you one very simple reason that explains that trend.
Okay.
There's nothing to clean. Like, I put the broccoli or the cauliflower or the corn on the grill, and I take it off, and I use my brush, and 2 seconds later, I'm done. I don't have as many things to wash. And I really try very hard in my books to put myself in the shoes of someone in their kitchen and think about how much work they're willing to put in for a dish. One of the things that I really respect is people's time. I'm not going to have a side dish that takes so long to make because that's only one part of a meal that somebody is planning.
Yeah. Paula, you're just so eminently sensible.
You are.
Thank you. I haven't been called eminently sensible. In fact, I think my children would argue that point.
But you could put that on your next book cover.
Here's what we need. We need you to get on the metro. Get up at the stop closest to that silly building on the top of the hill with a dome on it. And try and talk some sense into these.
Oh, that's a whole other show, Peter.
Yes, it is.
That's a whole different show.
Yeah.
Well, Paula, again, it's another great success, and I hope it does very well.
Yeah, no, I'm hoping that people, you know, buy. I want everybody to buy the book, whether you're Jewish or not, because these are really special recipes to me. When I was just eating the food from this book, I just felt lighter. I felt good. There wasn't anything processed in it. It really, I felt, added a lot to my life. And I'm very excited about that. And I think I want people to buy it as a Hanukkah present or a Christmas gift. But Hanukkah's coming up in a couple of weeks, and I definitely have Hanukkah recipes in the book. And I actually have a new product that I'm launching. Am I allowed to mention that? I have,
sure.
I'm working on releasing a series of do-it-yourself baking, Jewish dessert baking kits. And the first one is a donut kit for Hanukkah, which can be found on chosengifts.com.
Uh-huh.
And you get ingredients and tools and things to decorate your donuts with. So I'm very excited about that. I'm proud of it. And I'll come up with some other versions. Well, I'll probably do Rugelach and Babka at some point.
The donuts are healthy, your recipe?
I won't say. My donuts are natural. The ingredients are very simple, but they are fried donuts. But
yeah.
They're donut holes. See, the whole point is, if you're making donut holes, you can just have one. You don't have to have ten.
If you
have a big donut in your hand, like, I don't know anybody who could just eat half a donut. I don't think I could eat half a donut.
I'm excited about getting my latke license back.
Well, you know, you should make them for yourself anyway.
Yeah.
Latkes are very special food. I mean, they really, really are. And there's so many different ways to make them. There's like the chopped potatoes and the small shred and the larger shred, but really it's potato. You know, any kind of potato that needs oil, it's going to be good.
Well, potatoes are my favorite food, probably. I mean, to be honest with you, I really think potatoes are my favorite food. So,
yeah, I love potatoes. I would say French fries would probably be my desert island food. But like I said, my kids, they thought these baked latkes were great. So
we're going to try those, and Peter will take that. Well, Paula, again, thank you. Luck with your book.
Thank you so much.
It's on sale everywhere right now.
And people can come find me at thekosherbaker.com. I'm putting up new recipes there all the time.
Great.
And thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Paula.
There's a lady who really knows what she's doing, huh?
She's so prolific, too. I mean,
prolific, yeah. What does that mean? Does that mean
she writes a lot. And they're good.
Okay, all right.
She also has a lot of recipes.
I think she's an expert, too, right?
I think so.
Okay, great. Well, Paula, we thank you if you're listening in. And listeners, we hope you enjoyed this week's show. You'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.